I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. How quaint of Noah it seems now that when the world was ending the first time, he saved the animals two by two to regenerate the earth, but left the trees and the plants to die. We begin to see the egotism of a species learning very late in the day what those vanishing trees used to do to suck up the carbon and synthesize the oxygen that sustains us freeloaders on the life of trees. The decorated novelist Richard Powers is back with the trees side of a hard story. Powers is the artist who keeps reinventing himself in difficult trades, brain science, then modern musical composition before this, and now the overstory about trees. Lean into the trunk of a pine tree or an oak, a beech or an alder, and listen, Rick Powers is telling us. If our minds were a little greener, we'd learn that trees created our soil and cycle our water. They make the weather, build the air. Also, that the tree population we found on this planet is 95% gone. We're back in school this hour with Richard Powers after a five-year interval, this time starting in a living museum of trees from ancient times and all the world, the Arnold Arboretum in Boston. Part of the fun was hearing Rick Powers and the Arboretum's director, Ned Friedman, plunge into tree talk.
So there's the Arboretum in front of us. And this is a really special tree for the Arboretum. It's in our logo. It's the Dawn Redwood tree. And they're magnificent trees. They're deep fluting. There's a shape to the base of the tree that's just full of form and just sinuous beauty. Look at the color on that. Isn't that stunning? Look right here. That's a clone of the oldest ginkgo tree in China.
My goodness.
Wow.
The smell quickens me. I might not want to camp out under one, but I don't mind walking past.
It is that sense that you can compare and contrast bark, color, flowers, all in one spot.
So crisp.
A little scratch on the green and a good sniff there.
Yeah, come on, get in there.
Okay. Lean down and take a good...
Lemon, or...
Yeah, like lemon chiffon cake.
Yeah.
That's a good smell. Look at the shape of this guy.
I mean, one of the great things about trees is they don't shed their history.
It's in their bodies.
So it's just embedded. These are the branches from a young tree long ago that have been abscised, broken off, and then buried in the wood as it keeps going. There's just history here.
Does the arboretum kind of guy share Richard's sense that, holy mackerel, when you look at it from the tree's standpoint, millions of years, we're in the last days?
I'm pretty sure the earth will go on very well without us, which is where we're heading.
We're standing in the middle of conifers that have gone through mass extinctions already. Mm. It's not the trees that need to be saved. It's us.
In conversation at the Arboretum, Richard Powers picked right up on my reader's sense of a life-changing vision and a deep music of trees in the overstory.
I'll start by saying that in two very literal ways, this book was a life-changer for me. I was not in good shape 6 years ago, and not sure of the value of my aesthetic, and not sure what I had been able to accomplish and where it was going, and not sure what to do next.
Really? What do you mean, not doing well?
Retiring from the classroom, a kind of, you know, professional uncertainty, maybe just being a certain age, you know, maybe just being 55 years old and not knowing what the next stage of life was going to bring. And it was moving out to California and teaching at Stanford and being in this bizarre place wedged between Silicon Valley and the Santa Cruz Mountain Redwoods that just got me thinking about why I felt so edgy and so lonely. And I guess it was the realization that the loneliness that I felt was not for other people. There were plenty of dear friends and loved ones in my life. It was the loneliness of a human being who had been told increasingly by his culture that we are all that there is, that meaning is a somewhat arbitrary thing that you make for yourself. just a branch of individual commodity culture. That's your best shot. And it was this moment under the redwoods, which is, if you've ever walked in a redwood forest, these are immense cathedrals of nature that are operating on a different time frame.
I got to confess, I've not seen the redwoods. I've not been under.
Oh, Chris.
Where you go?
Yeah. So two.
Where you take me?
Yeah. So literally being up there and breathing that air, and finding another way into the woods, back into time, was really, in a sense, a rescue from the world that Silicon Valley had made for me and that was shuttling me down. So in that sense, falling in love with trees was a life changer. It gave me a passion again. It gave me a sense of meaning lying outside of myself, an aspiration to discover something that I had walked past for 55 years in relative blindness, and now a chance to take seriously other frames of time, other skills, other desires, other agencies, other ways of life, and to think there is another mission for us here.
Another way into the trees, you say, or into the woods. We're so proud around here of our number one all-time tree hugger, Henry David Thoreau.
Yes.
He set the bar high for praising trees, celebrating trees, loving trees. But you do something entirely different. As your plant Patty, one of your great characters here, says, I've tried to see this matter from the standpoint of the trees, which is not at all what Thoreau did.
That's right. Thoreau says, I've found a match at last. I've fallen in love with a scrub oak. But the scrub oak is still there for him. On the other hand, in his most profound moments as a prophet, he's saying, breathe the air, drink the drink, eat the fruit, resign yourself to the influence of the earth. And it was that I discovered in California, how to resign myself, live in each season as it passes, resign yourself to the influence of the earth. It was giving myself over to the time frame of trees and the incredible ingenuity of trees and the society of trees that got me back in the life game again. I spent 2 years reading about the forests of America and how between 95 and 98% of the forests on this continent when the Europeans came are now gone. Between 95 and 98%. In fact, here's another stunner. 55% or more of trees on this continent are younger than 40 years old. We've transformed forests into plantations, into tree farms, or second growth forest, which is magnificent in its own way. But I kept reading about how if you have only seen regrowth, if you have only seen the way the forest has come back from the axe, you haven't really seen what a forest can do yet. And you need to go to these last remaining pockets. And among the pockets for eastern trees, the sources that I kept reading were saying, if you want to see what an eastern broadleaf forest looks like, the Smokies is a great place to go. As you cross from what you think a forest looks like into what these old forests actually are, you can smell a difference. You can see a difference in the variable thickness of the trunks, the big gaps where the large old trees have fallen and torn out areas that are now nurseries for the new runners. The way the old growth sounds, just the incredible diversity of species and the intensity of biotic production, the way it makes you feel as you walk into it is profoundly different. And I loved that feel so much when I went to see these patches in the Smokies that I actually bought a house and moved there. And I've been living there for over 2 years now. So this book actually moved me quite literally into a new way of life. What I do all day long is profoundly different than what I do all day long before I started this book.
Spell it out.
I live now just a quarter mile from the boundary of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And my days now are spent in a different tempo, in a different activity. You know, an 18-mile day is a good day now. And a great deal of the writing gets done now, not in that deliberate commodity fashion of sitting down and saying, I need 1,000 words, or I'm not a real writer. It gets done now by walking and looking and waiting and having the story come to me. And if the commodity is not there at the end of the day, so be it. I'm healthier in body and mind than I was when I started the day. This book will always be the book where I went from being a person who was primarily interested in what people do to themselves and to other people, and became instead a writer interested in what we as a species do or don't do to all other forms of life. In other words, there are several ways you can tell a story. A person might be trying to come into some kind of accommodation with the conflicts in their own personality. And that's a beloved story in a culture that thinks that meaning is primarily a personal thing. Right? The psychological novel. It's a compelling story, and there are many, many wonderful books based on that. The next step up, of course, is somebody who knows what they value bumps up against somebody else who values something else, and they go to war. So that's the social or the political novel. We also do that very well. But when you think about it, literary fiction for a long time, I mean, you have to go back to the 19th century to find great works of literary fiction that went to that third level. People trying to accommodate the fact that non-people want something else. And the dream of the non-human is not the dream of the human, and we don't know how to resolve that tension. Right? You have to go back to Melville and you know the other great writers who are struggling with something beyond the made world. The reason is, I think, somewhere along the line, we thought we won that war. We thought that this program of being fruitful and multiplying and subduing the earth was done. And now we had our own way. We were the only ones left with agency, and everything else was just resource. And the world was ours to have dominion over. Well, we found out that's not the case.
Richard Powers' new novel is called The Overstory. It has a heroine known as Plant Patty, who's collecting and banking tree seeds for a future after extinction. Coming up, the real-life model of Plant Patty from Ottawa. She's a scientific tree hugger and a Celtic mystic as well, and she's got marching orders for all of us who would save the trees in hope of saving humanity. This is Open Source. Replanting the forest is the mission of Richard Powers' contentious characters in fiction. Their plan was defined by a tree scientist that Rick Powers has never met, Diana Beresford Kroger. She's a lyrical botanist with a Royal Irish accent, now living in tree farming in Canada. From Ottawa this week, she gave us a kind of confirmation of Richard Powers' imagination.
This is Plant Patty speaking.
At the moment we met her, she was sorting seeds of an endangered white cherry tree from Austria and papayas from Mexico.
Also, I have the species of a similar triloba, and I have been breeding different types of potatoes from the black potato, the Magdalene black potato. So I've got all kinds of goodies here that I've been saving for years and years. Oh, and I also have a resistant chestnut, your sativa species, your chestnut that is going back into America. And I hope to see your forests filled with this chestnut again.
I think you taught Richard Powers a great deal of what he knows, not only the science, but the inner life of trees. And we want you to teach us.
Richard painted a Jackson Pollock in words. Richard traveled in his mind, and he read in between all of the lines of my books. And he's a very smart guy, a very intuitive guy. You know, creative art in ancient Ireland is the word unfis. That means you have knowledge. In my mind, art pushes the wave of creativity in science. And his book is very, very important because it opens people's deep limbic intuitive knowledge that trees are very, very important.
Yeah.
And that is crucial for climate change.
Richard absorbed all this without meeting you.
Richard Powers dreamt of me because I hold my creativity in string lines across the globe. He is just one of many people who have dreamt of me. The Hopi people know me. There are all kinds of other people know me through dreams.
What Richard Powers and his readers learn from you is what those trees are doing. So many of the things that we do.
Yeah.
Would you take us into that inner world of trees? Some of it underground.
I will take you into a tree. I will take you into a tree right now. But for me to take you into a tree, I have to hold your hand. And I have to hold your hand in your mind. So I'm putting out my hand to you, and you are grasping my hand. We are one now in our consciousness.
Got it.
And our consciousness is going into the tree. Now, I want to say to you that the regulatory material in your body is called DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid is in you. The same compound is in the tree. The same nucleus is in the tree. Identical except for two bases. A tree is a living creature. It is a creature on this planet that we all look upon and say, oh, it doesn't have sentience. But I think maybe trees do have sentience based on our own thinking, because a tree will look after its children. A tree can identify its baby trees underneath the tree itself growing. Mm. And the tree will feed in carbon, underground carbon, to the young trees. And the young baby trees, they can identify one another. They will grow very well with one another. Mm. And that is all underground. But the majesty, the extraordinary, unbelievable thing about trees is that they have a canopy. The applicator system is the trunk. The trees farm the sun. And the trees understand photon sunlight in a way that was really a little bit of a mystery to Einstein. Einstein understood light travelled in straight lines. It travelled in straight line vectors, and it also travelled in sine waves. He didn't understand why the sine wave happened. But now we know. Had we talked to Einstein maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, he would have said, oh my God, this is what it is all about. Because the sine wave lands on a leaf. Every leaf of every tree all over the world. And what that sine wave does, it does a little dance on the leaf of the tree called plasmonics. And what happens is it can break the carbon in the air, carbon dioxide in the air, split it into two in what's known as the photosynthetic reaction. That is sunlight breaking carbon dioxide. And the carbon is digested into the tree and reformed in the shape of a sugar. And the sugars in the tree are the timber of the tree, the wood of the tree, the body of the tree, the makeup of the tree, similar to our bones in our body. And the oxygen is cracked off and floats out into the atmosphere. And the oxygen makes life for the planet. All mammals on the planet require that oxygen. And in fact, all of the soil requires it. All of the sea requires it. And the trees are the great manufacturers of oxygen. There is nothing like it on Earth. But the trees have learned over 400 million years to take the deoxyribonucleic acid, to take the DNA, and to form all kinds of extraordinary molecules. Serotonin is produced in the tree. The neurotransmitters are produced in the tree. All of the oleic, all of the essential fatty acids for our neural systems in your body and in my body are made by a tree. Sugars are made by a tree. 60% of all the complex medicines in the world are made by a tree. If you have had cancer, if you have had breast cancer as a woman, the taxane compound is made in the tree. And if you want protection from cancer, those extraordinary taxodiol compounds are made in the tree. We can't even make them in a lab right now. And that is the extraordinary aspect of the tree. And somehow all of our ancestors understood that. They placed them in the form of sacred species. They knew it by observation, just like we scientists see things by observation.
You get high.
Yes.
Close to trees. And you get better.
Yes.
Can we all do that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. How you do that is by forest bathing. For instance, if you need a jump up on your immune system, you go and you walk under pine trees. And the best pine in North America is called Pinus strobus. It's the white pine. So I'd say to you, just stand up straight, keep your shoulders back and breathe into your deep lungs, into your lower parts of your lungs. 15 minutes walk will give you a 30-day protection for your immune system. It boosts your immune system for all the diseases that come your way, including cancer.
Forest bathing.
Yes.
We're going to do it. Richard Powers' characters, 200 feet up in the crown of a redwood tree, see a busier scene than Times Square, much busier. Salamanders, not to mention birds. It's a highway of complicated life. Take us there.
Yes. Well, what happens is when you're in a mature tree, you're dealing with lichens, you're dealing with the mosses, you're dealing with the ferns that can live up there, you're dealing with the butterflies that come in and they lick the surface areas of the leaves, and that gives them all of the metal compounds that go into the colouring of the wings, which in turn is effective for their reproduction. And the birds do the same thing. All of life comes to the metropolis of a tree. The whole lot of life comes to the metropolis of a tree.
That's the overstory, as Richard calls it. Mm-hmm. Take us underground.
Oh, underground, my God. Underground is just unbelievable. Underground is the reverse of the upside part of a tree. Underground, you've got the roots going into the soil. And you know, the soil is a living system. The soil is consisted of cyanophyta, cyanobacterium. And there in the soil, you've got all kinds of creatures in the soil, all kinds of plant life in the soil, extraordinary things that we've only just discovered called bacteriophages. Were only discovered maybe about 10 years ago. And they're like rockets in the soil. Oh my God, it's just unbelievable. So the roots go down and there is a thing called trophisms. And they smell the water and they smell all the nutrients and they smell the quality of soil, and they pull out on the tips of the root hairs, they pull out what they need out of the soil. And in some instances, they push some toxins into the soil to actually stop competition in the soil. They are so smart. They are so unbelievably clever. And all of that soil then, all of that nutrients goes into the phloem and goes into the xylem. And that would be equivalent to your arterial and the venous system in your body. We understand how the arterial and the venous system in your body works, but we don't have the foggiest clue on how a tree can drag water up 40 stories into the sky. We do not know. And no university knows. No scientist knows. Nobody understands how they can do that. And if they do understand it, they'll get a Nobel Prize. Lickety split.
You say in the net, these trees, you call them the banks of nature, storing almost everything we need.
Now you come to climate change, really. This is something science has not understood until the last 20 or 10 years ago. What we didn't know is that 400 million years ago, the atmosphere was filled with carbon dioxide. And of course, that's deadly for the human being. It's deadly for mammals. What the trees have managed to do, they've learned how to pull the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And they are carbon banks. And they bank the carbon into their body. They bank the carbon into their roots. Then the leaves fall and the leaves actually do an extraordinary thing on their photoactive on the surface of the soil, and they produce a fulvic acid which goes into all the water systems and feed is the foundational feeding of all of the fish in the sea and the great systems in the sea. We didn't know this. That means carbon is tracked everywhere. It's tracked underground, it's tracked in the soil, but mainly it's pulled out of the air. And what we've done in the last couple of hundred years is we've taken down too much forest. And that really is what's happened. And if you go to California and you look at the redwoods, you cannot see the top of a redwood. You could lie down in the ground, it doesn't matter how big you are, and look and stare up into the sky. They're so big, you can't imagine how big they are. And those are banks of carbon. They have banked it in their bodies and banked it underground and banked it in the detritus and banked it in the benthic zones of the water and the lakes. lakes and the rivers, they've banked it everywhere. But we didn't know there was so much carbon banked into chemistry until now. Because what's happening now, it's being released into the atmosphere and now it's toxic for us. We're at the 400 parts per million. And it's awfully simple to reverse. Just go home and plant a tree, one tree per person for the next 6 years, and you'll pull the carbon dioxide down into the 400 parts per million. I've done the math. My God, it's simple.
Diana, your character in Richard Powers' novel, Plant Patty, says things like this, and I'd love you to extend them. But she says, men and trees are closer cousins than you think.
Yes.
Trees are doing science, running a billion field tests. They make their conjectures, and the living world tells them what works. Life is speculation, and speculation is life. What a marvelous word. It means to guess. It also means to mirror. Plant Patty says, trees stand at the heart of ecology, and they must come to stand at the heart of human politics. Tagore, the Indian prophet and wise man, said, trees are the earth's endless effort to speak to the listening heaven. But people, oh my word, people, says Plant Patty, people could be the heaven that the earth is trying to speak to. If we could see green, we'd see a thing that keeps getting more interesting the closer we get.
Yeah, yeah. Even the act of seeing green, the act of being around trees, changes your cortisol levels, your fright and flight on the adrenal glands that sit above your kidney. And what happens when you see green and you see a tree, it drops the cortisol level in your body. There is actually a system in your body that drops it, and you have no longer fright and flight. And that is why children are so attracted to trees and to forests, because it's a very scary world for a child. And you put a child into a forest, they see the trees and they hear the trees. But some people actually hear the ultrasound, the infrasound from trees. And they hear it in their chest. And in their chest, the size of a child, the size of a person, is like a viola or a violin or a big cello. And you actually register the sound of the trees, just like you'd register the sound of a large volcano.
Do you want to speak a little bit of that Canadian boreal forest, a piece of a forest on the crown of the planet that is terribly endangered in Russia as well as in Canada? And what are the stakes here in saving that ring of green at the top of the earth?
Yes. Nobody knows about the boreal forest system. Nobody does.
Nobody knows how the tar sands, the development of the tar sands, is eating into it either.
Yeah, nobody knows about, because it's so far away from everybody. It's so far away from civilization. I want to protect and I want to save that boreal forest. It is a system of forests that goes around the top of the planet like a crown or a monk's tonsure on his head. It goes from continent to continent to continent. The species that are dominant in North America are Pinus banksiana, and the species that are dominant on the taiga and on Europe are the Scots pine, Pinus sylvestris. The forest is phenomenal. The forest has learned to cope with the lack of sunshine. The forest has learned to cover the soil. It's learned to manufacture the most important compounds in the world from there. Even Putin called it the ecological shield of the world. That forest protects the great whales. All the great whales go up there to calve under the great oxygenation of that forest. It is the most important place in the world next to the Amazon forest. And what is happening now is industry is actually foaming at the mouth, because there's gold up there, there's oil up there, there's all kinds of minerals up there. It is like a great treasure in the planet. And the greedy people want to take it down. I say no. You can never replace that forest ever.
Am I crazy, or do we hear much, much more about the melting of Greenland than we do about the erosion of that absolutely vital forest?
Yes.
We see pictures of Greenland melting every week.
Yeah.
Nobody speaks of that forest the way you do.
Because the Greenland, it's easy to do, to go in there with a boat and to take a shot. And they're spectacular shots. It is melting. The whole of the northern area is melting. It's the canary in the stacks to let you know that something terrible is happening. Mm. But the problem is that you have people going into the forest, the boreal forest. They don't know one tree from another. They don't understand what trees are doing. And this is why I think Richard's book is so important. It hits the limbic area. I've been trying to do that for years and years so that people understand trees are important. They are beginning to understand it. The boreal forest is the most important unit of forest system on the planet. It is the greatest ecosystem on the planet. Mm. And the greedy want to get their sticky mitts on it. And I say no.
We say no with you. Diana Beresford Kroger, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome, Beg the Alath.
Diana Beresford Kroger, according to her friend, the ant biologist E.O. Wilson, speaks for the trees as well as it's ever been done. Coming up, Richard Powers again on the challenge out there for storytellers and novelists like himself to make the contest for the world as compelling as the struggles among a few lost people. This is Open Source. One of Richard Powers' big puzzles inside his tree novel, The Overstory, and in our face-to-face conversation, is why it is so hard for our species to see the sanctity in life that is not human, to see that humans aren't the only show on Earth, in fact, that in the longest of long runs, we may not even be the point of the story.
Yeah. I mean, another way that I've started thinking about this is, you know, when you talk to someone and they want to assert their pragmatic, clear-headed, clear-eyed vision, they'll say, I live in the real world. And when you step back from that, you realize what they're saying is, I live in the made world. I live in the human world as if there were no other alternative, as if the human world were somehow incontestable. We've so deeply been colonized by this idea that we're all there is, and the social world is the source of all rule and all meaning and all significance. If we could just unblind ourselves for a moment.
You got out of it by walking 18 miles, among other things, and moving to the Smokies. I wondered, Richard, could you teach that to your old Stanford students? Could you teach it to us? Isn't that part of what you're trying to teach us in this book?
I think it's what the book is trying to do. It's trying to tell a story that says there is sanctity that is not human sanctity. There is meaning that is not human meaning. There is agency that is not human agency. Let's find a way to tell that story. Now, ironically, we all knew that once. Think about Indigenous American stories, right? And the ways in which plants become agents and become things with purpose and behavior. And this is throughout the world. And the reason the book is so fascinated with Ovid, for instance, is those stories, people turning into plants and plants having, right. You know, we see in those trees, we want an origin story, we want an explanation as to why that tree looks so full of personality and dynamism. And the myth is connecting people back to trees. This is a post-scientific attempt to do Ovid. Mm. It's a way of trying to say, we can't go back to those myths, we can't go back to animism or pantheism in a pre-scientific way, but we can use those fantastic discoveries of the last several decades where people are finding out that trees are social, they have memory, they take care of each other, they feed each other, and Ovid starts coming back, and the indigenous myths about animals and plants having their own personalities and their own behaviors start coming back, and we start to realize, actually, there is a kinship. We just walked with Ned Friedman in the Arboretum, and in the way that he was talking about the adaptive qualities of these trees, he was animating them. Yeah. He was turning them back into beings, and we were seeing them not just as resources. We were seeing them as creatures that had a game plan. Humans are what they are by virtue of these other creatures that have all these other affordances and all these other powers. They've made our atmosphere for us very kindly. They've made our soils for us. Mm. They filter our water. They build our houses. They lay our railroads. Our biology is what it is because we came down from the trees. Our culture is what it is because we had this incredible patrimony to spend. We think we're the masters of the universe. We think we have, you know, dominion over life. We are parasites on these creatures that can take sun and turn it into everything that there is. That's the trap that we've gotten in. We don't realize that the challenge of living here and staying here is to stop seeing everything there is, everything else that's alive, as mere resource for the propagation of a human form of life that can't possibly be sustained.
And your man Adam in the book says, what keeps us from seeing the obvious? What is it, do you think?
Well, I think if you asked a developmental, an evolutionary behaviorist, for instance, they would say, our brains are shaped to be in love with ourselves, right? What we needed most adaptively at our point in evolution was to understand and keep track of these other animals in our tribes, right? We are very, very good at understanding things that look like us, are about our size, move at about our speed. So there is a natural predisposition, I think, in the affordances of the brain to be blind to things that don't look like us. But that's the miracle of awareness, and that's the miracle of human intelligence, that we can swim upstream against that tendency. So there is something in us that's capable of rising to this challenge of casting the net of identification out beyond the merely us. I was going to mention this famous essay that Christopher Stone wrote in 1974 called Should Trees Have Standing? And he starts the essay very beautifully. He sort of alludes to Darwin making this point that what we consider to be a person has gradually expanded over the course of human cultural history. That there were times when children were not people. There were times when women were not people, when the disabled were not people. And little by little, we've pushed that outwards.
Right.
Right.
And the Peter Singer School thinks that's progress. We're beginning to include animals,
yes,
for example.
Right. And in fact, Stone wrote the essay at the moment when the notion of standing and the notion of rights and the notion of personhood was beginning to be pushed out toward those people who we share 99% of our genome with, right? They're hominids. So the point of the essay was simply to ask, why is it that the human legal system needs to have a person as a victim, either physically or financially, before you can bring a lawsuit? If somebody's dumping toxins into a river or despoiling a mountain, you could not sue them unless there was somebody downstream, a person who was being harmed. And he's saying, why couldn't you bring suit on behalf of the river or on behalf of the mountain? And Stone makes an incredibly persuasive case. If we're letting companies be people, if we're letting universities, if we're letting ships be people, you know, if we extend this legal fiction into other kinds of prosthetic extensions of us, why not these things that we depend on?
Would you read that passage at the crown of a redwood, 200 feet above ground, where Nick, the artist, and Olivia, the redeemed druggie, struggle their way up to the other view, the tree's view, from a spot where the official line was, nothing happens, there's nothing there.
Right, right. And I'll just read this as they go on their voyage of discovery following their first breakfast up at the top of the redwood. They take breakfast al fresco. Their chill fingers feed hazelnuts and dried apricots into mouths that hang open, awed by the view. Sitting still and looking, their new job description. But they're humans, and soon enough, their eyes fill up. She says, let's explore. The main trails from the grand ballroom are laid out with loops and lobster claws, rope ladders, places to hook a carabiner to. She gives him the harness. Then she makes one for herself from three nylon climbing cables. Barefoot, you'll stick better. He wobbles out on a waving branch. The wind blows, and Mimas's entire crown dips and bucks. He'll die. plunge 20 stories onto a bed of ferns. But he's getting used to the idea, and there are worse ways to go. They head off in different directions. No point in trying to spot each other. He inches along one barrel-sized limb, cabled in, scooting on his pants seat. The scraped branch smells of lemons. A twig growing out of it holds a shock of cones, each one smaller than a marble. He takes one and taps it on his open palm. Seeds fall out like coarsely ground pepper. One sticks in the crease of his lifeline. From such a speck came a tree that holds him 200 feet in the air without flexing. This fortress tower that could sleep a village and still have room to let. From high above she calls, "Huckleberries. A whole patch up here." Bugs swarm, iridescent, party-colored, minuscule horror film monsters. He works his way to a strange junction, careful never to look down. Two large beams over the course of centuries have flowed together like modeling clay. He grapples to the top of the hillock and finds it hollow. Inside is a small lake. Plants grow along a pond flecked with tiny crustaceans. Something moves in the shallows, speckled all over in chestnut, bronze, black, and yellow. Seconds pass before Nick coughs up a name. Salamander. How did a damp-seeking creature with inch-long limbs climb two-thirds of the length of a football field, up the side of dry, fibrous bark? Maybe a bird dropped it here, fumbling a meal into the canopy. Unlikely. The chest of the slick creature rises and falls. The only plausible explanation is that his ancestors got on board 1,000 years ago and rode the elevator up for 500 generations.
Myself, why emotionally we love the grimness of this picture of us.
Yeah.
Since when, I mean, this is brand new in our lifetimes.
Yes.
The sense that, as even, you know, Ned Friedman said today, no, we're over as a species. We can see that. What?
Yeah.
My parents never even imagined that, nor did yours, I'm sure.
No.
When? Why?
No.
Is it reversible? Is it containable?
You know, I'm not a seer, and some forms of prophecy make better stories than other forms of prophecy. And in fact, you might tell one story, not because you think that's the way the story is going to unfold, but because you think by telling it that way, you might make it unfold another way.
You might get our attention. Anyway.
That's the uses of literature, right? Not to predict the future, but to actually shape it, even with, you know, a narrative that heads in the wrong direction. But I would say this. You ask, can we do it? Can we rejoin creation? Can we give up our sense of human exceptionalism? I'm going to say this. It will happen one way or the other. Either it'll be forced on us in a most catastrophic and cataclysmic way that greatly reduces our number and causes unimaginable suffering. Or we're going to use this incredible capacity, the singular capacity for distant foresight, for modeling, for imagination, speculation, amplified by these incredible prosthetics that we've built, and we're going to inch ourselves, you know, step by step into the new world. I can't set the odds on that, and I won't be around to collect, you know, if I did set the odds. But, you know, it is that human desire to send those messages out into the future that's going to make or break our capacity for this change in consciousness, for this adoption of tree awareness, of this unblinding.
On a single page near the end of the overstory, Richard Powers sums up the life of planet Earth, 17 billion years or so, as it might be fitted into one 24-hour day racing toward this moment in 2018.
Say the planet is born at midnight, and it runs for one day. First, there's nothing. 2 hours are lost to lava and meteors. Life doesn't show up until 3 or 4 a.m. Even then, it's just the barest self-copying bits and pieces. From dawn to late morning, a million, million years of branching, nothing more exists than lean and simple cells. Then there's everything. Something wild happens not long after noon. One kind of simple cell enslaves a couple of others. Nuclei get membranes. Cells evolve organelles. What was once a solo campsite grows into a town. The day is two-thirds done when animals and plants part ways. And still, life is only single cells. Dusk falls before compound life takes hold. Every large living thing is a latecomer, showing up after dark. 9 p.m. brings jellyfish and worms. Later that hour comes the breakout, backbones, cartilage, an explosion of bodily forms. From one instant to the next, countless new stems and twigs in the spreading crown burst open and run. Plants make it up on land just before 10. Then insects, who instantly take to the air. Moments later, tetrapods crawl up from the tidal muck, carrying around on their skin and in their guts whole worlds of earlier creatures. By 11, dinosaurs have shot their bolt, leaving the mammals and birds in charge for an hour. Somewhere in that last 60 minutes, high up in the phylogenetic canopy, life grows aware. Creatures start to speculate. Animals start teaching their children about the past and the future. Animals learn to hold rituals. Anatomically modern man shows up 4 seconds before midnight. The first cave paintings appear 3 seconds later. And in the thousandth of a click of the second hand, life solves the mystery of DNA and starts to map the tree of life itself. By midnight, most of the globe is converted to row crops for the care and feeding of one species. And that's when the tree of life becomes something else again. That's when the giant trunk starts to teeter.
Richard Powers, thank you for the overstory. Thank you for another memorable conversation.
It was truly my pleasure. It was such fun talking. Thanks for a great day.
Richard Powers' new novel is titled The Overstory. Thank you, Richard Powers. Thank you, Diana Beresford Kroger. Thanks also to Ned Friedman and Pam Thompson at Boston's Arnold Arboretum. Check our website for the video of our day in the Arboretum. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter. Subscribe to our podcast. Think of making a donation to the hardest working team in radio. Our show this week was produced by Tree Huggers All, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, and the artist Susan Coyne. Paul Kahlo is our engineer. Mary McGrath lives in the crown of our redwood. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.